You're listening to the Holocaust Educational Trust podcast series. The Trust works with schools, colleges, and communities across the United Kingdom to educate about the Holocaust and its contemporary relevance. To learn more about our programs for teachers and students, visit us online at het.org.uk. From the Holocaust Educational Trust, I'm Alex Maws, and this is the 70 Voices podcast. 70 Voices is a digital commemorative project from the Holocaust Educational Trust, marking 70 years since the end of the Holocaust by documenting its history through 70 unique sources. Follow the project as it unfolds online at 70voices.org.uk or download the 70 Voices app, available for most smartphones and tablets. I'm joined this week by two people. Both are historians, authors, and Holocaust educators. In London is my colleague Martin Winstone from the Holocaust Educational Trust, who researched 70 Voices. And joining us on the line from Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem is Jeremy Lee. Martin and Jeremy, welcome. So this week we have focused on life in the ghettos. Jeremy, could you start by explaining what are ghettos?
Sure. So ghettos, I mean, they predate the Holocaust period, and actually the term comes really actually from a much earlier period of history, from the late Middle Ages. They're Italian in origin, and the most common assumption is that the word comes probably from Venice, and it means a foundry, but it refers to something that existed on one of the islands in Venice where Jews were confined during the early 16th century. And so the idea of isolating Jews from the rest of the host society was at the time, sort of as a result of other types of persecution, quite different to the ones we see during the 19th century. All of those ghettos were abolished as the really through the 19th century, as the Jews were emancipated in most of the different countries of Europe. But the idea sticks around, and therefore the idea of creating a sort of a Jewish section of a town or a cluster of small towns brought together to have Jews in one location, that was the idea of a ghetto, that the word sticks around. Usually these were in quite poor areas. The actual idea of creating them was sort of initiated at the end of 1939, but they weren't really established until a little bit later on. But the idea was that Jews needed to be separated. The key thing is separation. And this was an innovation. This had not previously existed in the other areas where the Nazis were in control.
Very interesting. And Martin, you've done a lot of research into why the Nazis created ghettos, haven't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think particularly in the context of Poland, as Jeremy says, it's really in 1939 that the idea of ghettos first begins to appear. And it's actually quite an interesting area in terms of current historical thinking, where, as so often with the Holocaust, what we once thought has turned out not to be entirely true. There was always a sense that the Nazis were following maybe some sort of conscious plan of which ghettos formed a part. Actually now we're tending to find that ghettoization was much more haphazard, and actually that ghettos were not necessarily created by the SS as was often once thought, but largely actually by civilian local Nazi officials, which I think tells us something quite important about the Holocaust, that it isn't simply the people we think of as the obvious perpetrators, the SS, the police, and so on, but also ordinary civil servants, and often also people like public health officials. In occupied Poland, for example, doctors were very active in pushing for ghettos, partly because they believed that somehow Jews posed a risk to public health. There was a belief that Jews were genetically prone to certain infectious diseases such as typhus, and therefore they needed to be isolated. So what we actually see is, rather than the rolling out of a master plan, instead ghettos being created at different times. It's also worth saying they were only in certain countries, as Jeremy mentioned. Prior to 1939, the Nazis had not created ghettos in Germany or Austria or the Czech territories. Even thereafter, it's only really in Poland, later on the occupied Soviet Union, and much later on occupied Hungary. And with a couple of exceptions elsewhere, that's pretty much it. And ghettos were created at different times. Even in Poland, most ghettos were only created in 1941 or even 1942, once the Holocaust was underway. So I think that that stresses that the really, as I say, the Holocaust is something where lots of individual local officials are contributing to this process of persecution. And they're doing so because of the ingrained anti-Semitism which characterizes Nazism, seeing Jews as a threat to security or as a, as I say, as a public health threat. Also, as time goes on, ghettos become a means of concentrating Jews prior to their deportation, which initially was not intended to be to the extermination camps. Initially, there were these plans, which previous weeks have looked at, to deport Jews to remote locations, either in Poland or in Africa. And so the ghettos were created actually for a number of different reasons, but underpinning them, I think, is this sense, obviously, of anti-Semitism, of seeing Jews as somehow malignant and a force that therefore has to be contained.
Mm. And listeners who are also following along with the 70 Voices project online or on the app will have read some really compelling sources this week documenting the conditions in the ghettos. Jeremy, can you talk a little bit about what life was like in ghettos?
Sure. I mean, in a way, obviously we rely a lot for our understanding on a number of sources, but the most important ones are clearly the diaries or the written documents, and obviously as much as possible on testimony of people who survived. And they reveal all sorts of things. I mean, it's almost an interesting thing to step out for one moment and imagine, what does one imagine it would look like? First of all, there's a question of time. Initially, when people are uprooted from the area of the city that they were previously living and moved into a new area, irrespective of whether the conditions were good or bad, there's this sense of rupture and dislocation. So psychologically, I think from the very beginning, people struggled to try and work out exactly where they really were, even though physically, you know, they may find themselves living in, you know, a house or a building that they could at least have imagined something like that. Obviously, the key characteristics are enormous overcrowding. You take a population, you squeeze it into a very small area. Jews represented about a third of the city of Warsaw, but were squeezed into an area much smaller than that. I use Warsaw as the example because it was the largest of all the ghettos in Europe. And you know, here we're talking about a population of over 350,000 at the very beginning. And in some cases, we have examples also in Poland where a group were moved from one area all the way to another area. So we have Jews from Berlin arriving in a ghetto in Łódź or Lodz in Poland, which only add to the greater sense of anxiety that there's less room for everybody. But I think beyond that, the most common characteristics that people, you know, in terms of hardship are poverty, resources and food and health questions, enormous problems, clearly, obviously, of a confined population living closely together. Once there are diseases, then these spread very, very quickly. And that refers a little bit maybe to what Martin spoke about before. But I think over and above all, everything else, there's this sense of tremendous privation, that people are struggling between the world of normality and abnormality. One of the questions I think that maybe historians come to ask, obviously, this looks like an abnormal situation where people are living, and they're trying to make it as normal as possible. But did the norms of everyday society continue? Did people try and establish all the sort of the patterns of life they would normally have? And one of the things that seems most remarkable is that we find educational projects, we find religious institutions, we find cultural institutions continuing to exist in these, you know, impossible situations. Maybe one last thing to say, which is to return to what I said earlier, the fact is the situation in, say, 1940, in some cases 41, is obviously going to be very different as the effects of the Holocaust come to bite further. So I think two things are worth saying. As people, the calorie allocation of what people, or the amount of food that could be brought in to kind of bulk up the amount of calories that a person needs to live, as that got less and less and harder, people's situation gets more desperate. And so there we certainly find testimony where people say, you know, amongst more than anything else, the only thing they could really think about was food. And that sort of became all-consuming. And that, of course, is relevant when we think about other areas of how people lived in ghettos, which was that, you know, the only thing that could motivate them to do anything was the question of eating. And the other thing that I wanted to say is, so in other words, as the privation increased and starvation increased and desperation increased, then there's this other psychological aspect, which was, once the deportations began, then people are beginning to realize that the end is coming. One could say that the condition at the very beginning, psychologically, was that people were hoping against hope that this was going to somehow be as bad as it was going to get. And by the end, of course, they're realizing that actually that's not true, and that deportation, being moved out of these ghettos somewhere else, may be just, this is actually just a way station to something further down the line. Of course, what comes into that then is an element of denial, where people almost, because the physical situation was so awful in the ghettos themselves, may have been more willing to get on the trains to take them to their deaths. But on the other hand, this kind of nagging sense, and articulated, by the way, obviously by some people, that actually this was not the end of the line. There was something worse further down the line.
Mm. Thinking about the ways in which Jews responded to ghetto life. One of the sources in this week's 70 Voices installments was a poem by someone whose work you introduced me to, Mordechai Gebertig. Jeremy, who was Gebertig?
Gebertig was he was a political activist, but fundamentally he was a folk singer. He was a sort of a folk artist, and politically he was a member of the Bund, which was a Jewish revolutionary party in Poland or in Eastern Europe. He lived in Krakow, and he was a very popular character in amongst mainly working class, but not exclusively working class Jews in Krakow and the area around. And he was well known. And see, so what's interesting about him, and he's writing, by the way, in Yiddish. That was the language, the lingua franca of most of the Jews of Poland, and most of the Jews of Eastern Europe, in fact. And what's interesting is that for him, he has a whole body of work, of songs, of poems that he wrote before he was taken into the ghetto. And therefore, when he's in the ghetto, he continues to be creative. And in a way, one imagines how the muse, how inspiration happens in such a radically changed environment. And so therefore, his poem, you know, you can hear this sort of yearning or longing for another world, a world which he remembers. And obviously, hopes will kind of be recreated. Although I think by the end of the poem, you get the sense that he can see that the end is coming. So Gebertig was, a man of the people. He was an artist, and he was somebody who was also a sort of an interpreter. He interpreted the events back to the community that he felt he was connected to.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to move on to another element of the ghetto, the history of ghettos, that's possibly sort of, you know, lesser known by people who aren't necessarily historians, who don't engage with this all the time, and that's the role of Jewish councils. Martin, what was the role of Jewish councils in the ghettos?
Yeah, well, I think it's worth saying to start that Jewish councils, for the most part, actually predated ghettos. Even in Germany in the 1930s, the Nazis had tried to encourage the development of single institutions through which not that Jews could be represented, but through Jews could be communicated with. And after the invasion of Poland in 1939, very, very quickly, again, initially at a local level, individual SS officers or civilian officials ordered in particular towns and cities the creation of councils. Then from late 1939, across Nazi-occupied Poland, these councils were created. So essentially, how they were created and who sat on them varied, but essentially they were there to first and foremost transmit whatever instructions or orders there might be, and there were plenty of those, from the Nazis to Jewish communities. Also at the same time, there was an element that Jeremy mentioned, continuity earlier. There was an element of continuity here in the sense that in Eastern Europe, in many towns and cities, you'd had community councils which represented the Jewish community. And the Jewish councils, in a way, were a continuation of this system. And initially, at least, were often welcomed by communities. There was the feeling that somehow there was a voice to represent them to the occupier. However, as time went on and as the burdens which were placed on the councils increased, in terms of things like how the Nazis would demand that they find sufficient numbers of people to carry out forced labour, for example, or the councils were responsible for distributing the rations to Jewish communities, which, as Jeremy mentioned earlier, were wholly inadequate. So increasingly they became, in many places, not everywhere, subject to criticism. So they were often particularly accused of collaboration. And also there were often allegations, particularly perhaps in Warsaw, of corruption. So, for example, there are many testimonies from Warsaw about forced labour recruitment, where if a big enough bribe was paid, then someone would be exempted. And that relates to another issue about ghetto life, which is in some ghettos, particularly larger ghettos such as Warsaw, one tended to find social divisions emerging. Although we tend to think of the widespread poverty in ghettos, which Jeremy mentioned, at the same time, the food crisis which existed in ghettos led to smuggling. And one of the most powerful sources this week is the poem The Little Smuggler, which highlights a very widespread phenomenon in the Warsaw ghetto: children smuggling essential food into the ghetto. But at the same time, there were also much bigger scale smuggling operations going on, often in league with corrupt German policemen, also Jewish policemen. Each ghetto had its own Jewish police force. And so the people who had the money, and perhaps to an extent the status within ghettos, were often exempted from the obligations placed on the community as a whole. So the councils became, as I say, subject to quite stinging criticism from many ghetto diarists, for example. At the same time, though, we have to recognise that these were individuals, many of whom had been active in public life before the Second World War, individuals who sometimes were forced to take on these positions, in other cases felt that it was their duty. For example, Adam Chernyakov, the head of the Jewish Council in the Warsaw Ghetto, had the opportunity to flee in 1939, as did many of his erstwhile colleagues, but he chose to stay, to see this as his duty in some way to try to protect the community. So although the councils often were characterised by corruption, and in the nature of ghetto life it could hardly probably be otherwise, because everybody was seeking to survive in the appalling conditions which they faced, for the most part these were people trying to do their best. And a phrase which I think we'll return to in later weeks, which is often used to describe the choices facing Jewish leaders during the Holocaust, is choiceless choices. The idea that whatever one did, there was never going to be a perfect solution. And so I think the Jewish councils, for the most part, did try to protect their communities. In particular, in many ghettos, organised extensive welfare activities to assist the population, and also often, although they were there to transmit Nazi orders, also to some extent subverting them through, for example, the creation of illegal schools, which existed in quite a number of ghettos. Some ghetto schools were eventually permitted, but in the majority they were not. But nonetheless, members of the councils were engaged in promoting these activities. And also in some ghettos, such as, for example, Kaunas, the final reading of the week is from an official of the Kaunas Ghetto Council, Avraham Tori. In Kaunas, the Jewish council leadership there was actively involved in helping the Jewish resistance movement that existed in the ghetto.
If I may add just one brief point, because I want to pick up on one thing that Martin said right at the very beginning, which is, you know, you asked the question, you know, who really were the councils? And I think there's almost a question that we could all sort of ask, which is whether these were leaders who were created by the moment, by the crisis that confronted them, or whether these were people who in some way were, well, I don't know if it's an appropriate thing to say, but were really essential kind of leader type people. They were people who were public spirited. They were people who understood the values of not just self-interested type of leadership, but rather genuinely trying to do something for their community, for their people. And I think that the early research on Jewish councils was very focused on the end, where council leaders were being asked to drop list of people to be deported. And in the question of who would be deported, the sense was that somehow the Jewish council leaders were letting the side down or were collaborating. And the early research seems to suggest that actually enormous numbers of people don't comply with that. They find other strategies. They either kill themselves, they run away, they allow themselves to be arrested or deported themselves. And then, of course, the Nazis have to find somebody else. And really, just to cut to the end of that kind of research, what it suggests was many Jewish council leaders were the kind of people who were motivated by a sense of public spiritedness and a value of trying to care for others. They were the kind of people who would normally be leader type figures. And it's really by the end, where the Nazis either having to do the job themselves that because they can't find anyone else to do it, or it's people who are just doing it out of the sense of self-interest. But I think more than that, to really understand that even within that, there were elements of continuity of the human spirit as a, in a way, maybe trying to survive in very, very desperate times.
And Jeremy, I can remember being in Vilnius on a teacher study visit with you and talking about this very issue of choiceless choices. And so this is, it brings us sort of right up to date that, as a Holocaust education charity, we're encouraging teachers to think about the really complex moral issues that are at the heart of the history of the Holocaust. And I suppose that's really what this 70 Voices project is all about, is encouraging other people out there, other listeners and other readers on our website, to engage with these types of stories as well. So I think that's a good and very thought-provoking point on which to end this episode of the 70 Voices podcast. So thank you both. To both of you, Martin and Jeremy, for contributing this week, and we will speak again.
Thank you for listening to the Holocaust Educational Trust podcast series. This series is just one of the ways in which the Trust promotes greater awareness about the Holocaust and ensures that it has a permanent place in Britain's collective memory. If you'd like to make a financial contribution in support of this work, or to learn more about our programs, visit us online at het.org.uk.